I'm Isa Ali, Brit of Iranian heritage. In recent years, British-Iranian tensions have risen to great levels. The media portrayal of Iran in the media tends to be negative, with Iran regularly accused of extremism. Iranians, meanwhile, view the British as an imperial power who's determined to impose their domination over the country once again. I decided to try to get to the bottom of this relationship between the two countries by speaking to the leading academics and experts in order that I may not be influenced by the sensationalism of the mainstream media. It's important in any discussion to look back into the history in order to gain an understanding of the modern day relationship. Reza Khan took power in Iran in order to build a strong central government and a strong army. This was primarily in the interests of Britain, as they needed a strong man to resist and stand against the spread of communist propaganda coming from Russia. Not to mention to secure the internal political situation in a country which had faced much instability. Reza Khan also managed to curb a lot of the anti-British sentiment amongst the clergy of Iran. The ascendance to the throne of Reza Khan was consistent with Britain's goals in the country. During the transitional period from 1921 to 1925, the British government adopted a cautious stance, ensuring that they didn't give Reza Khan too much public support. The attaché from the British embassy, Nicholson, later wrote that Reza Khan's ascent to power was greatly indebted to the ambassador of Britain. However, during World War II, the Shah would find out for himself that British support was not consistent. In 1941, the British and the Americans engineered the overthrow of the Shah in favour of his son, fearing that he had become too close to the German axis.
But I think the British really misunderstood Reza Khan. There's a famous quote from Norman, who was the British minister at the time of the coup, about Reza Khan being a simple-minded soldier with no political ambitions. The British just didn't realise what they were doing. And it's really, it's a common story. The imperial powers install a figure whom they think will do their bidding in some general sense, and then they unleash a process over which they quickly lose control. And that's what happened here, I think, because very quickly Reza Khan turned against the British.
The new Prime Minister knew that finding a replacement for Reza Shah, who would rule with the same authority, was impossible. He also knew that the reforms would not survive if Reza Shah stayed. Thus, it was decided that the BBC would start broadcasting programs in Persian. It began with some previously recorded programs, then some words were said about a constitutional government, and then, to give it some zest, Reza Khan's bad management and merciless behavior were to be covered for all to bear. If the Iranian people agreed with what they were hearing, it would be a severe blow to Reza Khan, and he would ask the Prime Minister to put a stop to the broadcasts, which of course would be useless. Sheikh Khaz'al was the governor of Khorramshahr. To be taken seriously, he needed help from the foreigners, so he took every opportunity to gain favor with the British.
They actually encouraged, as far as the history shows. First, they are denying. Sheikh Khaz'al played the, say that he is caught in many ways. He noticed that Reza Khan, or Reza Shah later, is a very, say that, forceful man. And he was afraid of the attitude of the Reza Shah, not because he knew that Reza Shah is a very strong man and determined man. And he actually, the Britain was concerned about the emergence of the Reza Khan in the center. And therefore, they encouraged Sheikh Khaz'al to seek for autonomy for the southern part of Iran.
Sheikh Khaz'al's first steps in building a relationship with Britain was by protecting the lives of William MacDougall in Khorramshahr, who was the British Vice Consul. Sheikh Khaz'al invited the British Vice Consul to participate in a confidential meeting, seeking his support in bringing him to power. Having already established a close relationship with Britain,
In the year 1898, Tehran officially recognized Khazal and gave him the title his brother, Mu'azzil Sultana, once had.
And so one of the things that Reza Shah did was centralize control of Tehran over the southern littoral. And Sheikh Khazal, who was a tribal chief and sitting on a lot of that region, the Abadan region, and one of the only rivers, in fact, that Persia has that emptied into the Persian Gulf, and critical, therefore, for the transport of the oil into the from the fields into the tankers. He was ousted. There were a number of other Arab tribal chiefs that commanded that region.
Sheikh Khazal made an agreement for oil exploration with the British oil company, Anglo-Iranian Oil, now known as British Petroleum.
With Sheikh Khazal because of the oil concession. And I think for the British during the First World War, particularly the political resident in the Persian Gulf, the idea became increasingly attractive of separating the oil province, Khuzestan, from the rest of Iran and turning it into another Arab Gulf sheikhdom under British protection. And Sheikh Khazal was the figure that they identified as key to this.
Sheikh Khazal led an uprising against the central government of Reza Shah. The uprising was crushed and Sheikh Khazal was taken to Tehran, where he died in captivity.
The right way for Britain to go would be simply to declare Khuzestan, which Percy Cox always referred to as Arabistan, to simply declare this an independent country, install Sheikh Khazal as ruler, and see it as another element within this network of existing British-protected rulers in the Gulf. And I think this was a real possibility down till 1918, 1919, when it was once more abandoned by the British. But I think it remained a very powerful fear within the Iranian psychological perception of this region.
But, I mean, this was all to do with Reza Shah's establishment of control over the whole territory, which in fact he did very effectively indeed with a greatly increased army.
During Reza Shah's time, the British had a general policy regarding the United National Leaders. This was to convince the leaders of the nomads and various tribes that they were obliged to pay their overdue taxes and had no choice but to accept their financial responsibilities toward the central government. They would have to come to an agreement with the financial ministry regarding their overdue and future taxes. The same expectations were communicated to Sheikh Khazal in the south, who had benefited from Britain's support. But no one was used to this kind of behavior from Britain, so they tried to resist the pressure by using the traditional method of procrastination. They believed the government was indebted to them, not the other way around. They made it very clear that they would prefer to ignore the orders than to shouldering the responsibility of taxes.
In 1929, in the south and southwest region of Iran, the key tribes of the Bakhtiari, Kashkai, and some of the smaller tribes began widespread rioting. According to many Iranians, the British government strongly supported these riots in order to destabilize the rule of Reza Shah. The root of the tensions in Iranian-British relations really start to take shape when Britain begins to get a hold of controlling Iran's oil resources. This control over Iran's resources can be traced back to the Knox-Darcy concession. Knox Darcy was a British industrialist who had gained British government support in order to try to gain control over Iranian oil resources. Darcy himself writes in his memoirs that one of the main reasons he was sent to try to secure Iranian oil concessions was in order to limit the Russian financial and political support for the Iranian Qajar king. As a result, Knox Darcy was simply enacting British foreign policy in trying to gain influence over Iran ahead of the Russians.
In his memoirs, Sir Arthur writes, "It was time to return to Iran. I thanked and said farewell to my host, Colonel Noumaich, who made me feel at home throughout my stay in Iraq. Along with my companions, I set out for Iran on horseback. We galloped through Baquba to Khanaqain, and a day later, we arrived in Ghasr Shirin, a city inside Iranian territory, close to the border with the Ottomans. Once there, I saw with my own eyes that Darcy Oil Company was up and running. Darcy was founded by William Knox Darcy, and I had secured the concession for his company to explore for oil upon setting foot in Iran. It was clear that huge reserves of valuable oil were going to be discovered. One of Ketapchian's sons, who had been employed by Darcy to monitor the exploration operations in Ghasr Shirin, accompanied us all the way from the city to Kermanshah to see us off.
The Darcy concession initially is for to explore and look for oil. They search around about the turn of the 20th century for some time without success. They're on the point of giving up and going home, and they find some oil, and then they begin to exploit oil, that brings the British into southwest Iran and into the tribal areas of southwest Iran in a way that they haven't been before. And in the long run, that becomes one of the key themes in British-Iranian relations as we go into the 20th century.
Once the concession was signed, Knox Darcy himself was invited back to London to celebrate with the British political elite.
Darcy, who was the one that had put up the money, was, although he was part of what later would become the Commonwealth, not a British citizen, but somebody who certainly lived in Britain and used the British currency, came in and felt that there was some real reason to think that in the South there was a lot of oil. And this was because there were many fires that would spontaneously come through the stones of that region, and which, of course, was the basis for Zoroastrianism.
I'm on my way to Parliament to interview Jeremy Corbyn, MP, about the historical role of Britain during the Qajar period and get a more political perspective on how that's affected relations today.
Well, Curzon was the ultimate British imperialist, who was, of course, Governor General of India, Foreign Secretary, and really wanted to be Prime Minister. In fact, he was desperate to be Prime Minister, and he thought it was just very unfair that he wasn't Prime Minister. He was that kind of person.
He himself said, "I hope this investment will benefit Britain and British influence in Iran." For Darcy, he viewed this as a way to ensure that British government support would continue to come for all of the projects he had planned within Iran. He expected the British government's diplomatic and political staff in Iran to always welcome him and to ensure that any needs he had were fully backed up by British diplomatic might.
The decisive moment when oil ceases to be a commercial interest for one company or another and starts to become a British national strategic interest or imperial strategic interest is when, just before the beginning of the First World War, the British decide that they will move the Royal Navy over from coal-burning ships to oil-burning ships. And then being able to secure reliable sources of oil, which you can feel confident that you will have access to even during wartime, and of course World War quickly follows, becomes an absolutely essential plank of British strategic policy. And that's when we see, both in Iraq and in Iran, the oil industry move from being, an interesting and profitable commercial concession to being something which government is crucially interested in.
The Foreign Ministry believed that the rejection of Darcy's loan application by the Ministry of Finance was indicative of the narrow-mindedness of the ministry's officials. Lord Lansdowne, the British Prime Minister at the time, warned about the threat of Russians taking control of the oil concession. Harding, who had the same concern, was afraid that the Russians would take control of the vast Iranian oil reserves and, as a result, expand their territories. He insisted that Britain had to protect and preserve the concession at any cost.
Whilst Russian expansion was a worry, Darcy, and by default the British government, also viewed France as a threat to their interests in Iran. Darcy had received funding from many different quarters, including from Burma.
I have to tell you at this moment of time, not only Britain, but the whole world are got a great owe or due to Iranian, the owe to the Iranian for winning, especially especially the Second World War, due to using our oil and petroleum for their own army. And this is something we need to mention over here. Yes, that was important. And also, when the discovery of the oil, you mentioned that, I have to say that at that time, when the oil discovery of the oil took place, and then the British bought over the 60% of the share of the and they established the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, as we know right now. British Petroleum created in Iran. There is no British Petroleum. British Petroleum established in Iran.
Addressing the House of Commons 10 years later, Pertyman explained how Lord Strathcona agreed to his request. I went to see Lord Strathcona in person and discussed the matter with him. I asked him to support Darcy with his name and wealth so that we, Britain, wouldn't lose the concession. The Lord asked only one question. He asked, are you telling me that the success of this project would benefit the British Navy if I got involved? And after I answered in the affirmative, he didn't ask any other questions and agreed to my request, hands down. Afterwards, Lord Strathcona asked the Burma Oil Company to start negotiating with Darcy. He called on Darcy Oil Company to stop all negotiations with foreign investors. In 1905, Lord Strathcona's efforts bore fruit.
Having received the support from Burma and other quarters, Darcy was on the verge of giving up until, one morning, he seemed to have struck gold, black gold. This significant finding of oil in Masjid Suleiman marked the beginning of British dominance over Iran's oil resources.
Lord Darcy discovered oil there, but it wasn't really, took a long time to, of course, commercially exploit it. And then we had the First World War, when it was absolutely vital for the British war effort that the ships were using oil and not coal. But how much this really affected Iran, how informed people were about the sort of sort of way plundering of Iran's natural resources was certainly how it became.
There's plenty of evidence to suggest that the first admiral of Britain's navy had always paid special attention to Iran's oil as a strategic resource, and for this had built up close relations with Darcy in order to better understand the best strategies to secure this important and vital resource.
Set up in, I think, 1909, and then nationalised by Winston Churchill, he was very clever, was Churchill. Very, very clever in lots of ways. I mean, I'm not saying I liked him or agreed with him, that's not the point. He was clever and far-sighted, and for somebody that had been brought up as a classical literarist, albeit also a kind of swashbuckling journalist, he recognised the scientific approach to war. So he recognised that Britain needed oil more than coal in 1910, 1911, when the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was nationalised, which later became BP, and of course later on in the Second World War.
Following the financial disputes between the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company from 1914, the British government emerged as the largest single shareholder. What was supposed to have begun as a joint venture between Britain and Iran soon became clear that this was a British-only venture, as the Iranian government and the cabinet were sidelined. This period of tension between Iran and Britain led to a complaint being made to The Hague by the Iranian parliament. In the end, a mediation was made, and the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company and Iran signed an agreement where a contract was given for oil exploration. What role did the UK play in the 1933 oil contract?
Some of that BP to have an interview. We just wanted to know if we could go in and ask someone at the desk if...
You contacted somebody?
Yeah, we've contacted somebody. We spoke to the press officer, my director did anyway.
He's not with you, yeah?
Yeah. I contacted BP because I wanted to set up an interview with one of their executives. I'd emailed and I'd phoned them, and initially they seemed fine with it and they'd wanted to set up a contact. But the moment I mentioned Iran, that's when the contact completely stopped and they refused to answer my emails or phone calls. It seems the topic of Iran is something still very sensitive for BP, who, as we know, used to be known as the Anglo-Persian and then Anglo-Iranian oil company.
As far as British officials were concerned, interfering in Middle Eastern affairs were for only two purposes: in order to control oil and to counter Russian influence. At this point, Saudi Arabia's oil hadn't yet been developed. As such, Iran played a crucial role in the game for oil. Over the course of several decades, Iran's oil revenues had increased, and Iran demanded more power to monitor and manage the financial resources that this oil was bringing into the coffers. As such, the 1933 revision of the oil contract included the agreement that Iranian government officials would have more power in managing and overlooking the operations of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Part of the changes which were included in this oil contract included a 50% royalty to be paid to Iran for each ton of oil extracted.
And right about 1933, the Shah decided to revoke the concession he'd given to Darcy. And the Americans and the British got together and actually signed a new contract in 1934. It made them realize how much they needed the security of the oil, and also made the Shah realize how much he needed external help. So that's really how it started off in 1934. Then in 1935, Pasha became known as Iran. So it became the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company.
But the British, while backing one company and guaranteeing the sale of cheap and plentiful oil in the future, entered the oil talks of 1932 and 1933 with other objectives in mind. For one, they said that protecting Iran's interests in the south would help Iran preserve its traditional status in the Persian Gulf. Consequently, as the British themselves said, their interference in the company's business was not to secure oil for England, but to counter the threat toward India. At the time, Britain had oil deals with other countries as well. So if this problem was solved quickly and with minimal animosity, the likelihood of similar scenarios occurring between Britain and its other oil partners would be reduced considerably. After World War I, rumors started spreading that Britain intended to create a new kind of imperialism based on oil. These rumors led to many an attack on Britain by those who opposed the idea. But Britain dodged the blows by referring the issue to an international organization. By doing so, it demonstrated its goodwill regarding its oil deals with various countries. This also reduced the volume of domestic criticism it was getting.
It became clear to me that this agreement in 1933 gave Britain significant strategic benefits. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which was initially intended to be a joint venture between Britain and Iran, eventually ended up becoming completely dominated by the British side.
Oil refineries at Abadan, in the land that used to be called Persia. Vital strategic country between Iraq and the Soviet Union, one of the richest oil fields in the world. In early August 1941, all but in the grip of Hitler through his famous troop of foreign tourists. Now, by swift action by the British Empire and the Soviet, snatched from the enemy's hands. In late August, tanks of the Empire armies moved into Iran. Troops drawn largely from Indian regiments began the occupation of this land whose ruler, for his own gain, was about to sell his countrymen into Nazi slavery. The occupation was completed quickly, though many still think not quickly enough. And though most people feel that the rounding up of Axis agents should have been carried out much more drastically, this action was at least another instance of Britain getting her blow in first. The pipeline is under guard. Gradually, in this uphill fight, the British Empire is extending her influence. Before we finish this war, the world will know again that Britain means what she says. Life goes on much the same despite the occupation. There was very little resistance. In fact, it's pretty obvious from these pictures that the vast majority of the Iranian people had no desire to collaborate with Nazi Germany. This mighty oil business was developed largely by British brains and British capital. It would have been a rich prize for Hitler, but this was not to be another Romania.
As such, the fallout from this agreement could be described as the beginning of the Anglo-Iranian oil dispute.